Gunther Schiller has made an impact on just about every facet of music. He's a composer, conductor, arranger, educator, critic, and historian. And he's made connections between parts of the music world that seem to be at odds with each other. Although he's from a classical background, he's been an ardent supporter of jazz, always insisting that jazz and classical music were different but equal in artistic value. Since the 1950s, he's been at the forefront of third-stream music. Third-stream is an expression he coined to describe music located halfway between jazz and classical music, combining the rhythmic vitality and improvisational spontaneity of jazz with the compositional techniques of classical music. The music Schiller composes is modern, yet he's always rooting around in the past, rediscovering music, then presenting it in concert and on record. For instance, he helped start the ragtime revival and conducted the Nonesuch recording of Scott Joplin's Redback Book. He's written extensively on jazz history. Next fall, Oxford University Press will publish his book The Swing Era, which is a companion to his book Early Jazz. Gunther Schiller is the former president of the New England Conservatory of Music and the former artistic director of the Berkshire Music Center at Tanglewood. I spoke with him from station WBUR in Boston. I asked him if he ever tried to specialize before branching out into so many different forms of music.
Not really. I seem to have been always fascinated by a multiplicity of musics. And some of that has to do with the fact that I, as a teenager, was growing up in New York, where through the many radio stations there, for example, there were three radio stations that carried classical music, and of course the many performing ensembles, but also jazz stations and stations that played other kinds of popular vernacular music. Through all of that, I somehow instantly became fascinated with this richesse of different kinds of musics. I had to specialize, of course, to some extent. I mean, that's what one has to do to make a living. And in that sense, I became a composer primarily of classical music and became a French horn player.
I knew you first through your work with third stream music. I'd like to talk with you a little bit about that. First of all, let me ask you to describe in your own words what you meant when you coined that expression.
Yes, well, it was the bringing together of two main streams of music, classical and jazz. I perceive them as main and as equivalent in their quality, although different in style. And the marriage of these two main streams begets, as the Bible would say, an offspring, a child, and that is the third stream. Now, what I was not talking about was some kind of simplistic or superficial overlays of one kind of music on top of another, but a real integration at the most fundamental technical and conceptual and expressive levels. And part of the... Now, this is not a music that I invented. I simply gave it a name, a very simplistic name, as a matter of fact.
Did you run into resistance on both sides, resistance on the part of people involved with jazz and classical music, about
the idea
of merging the two in some way?
Oh, absolutely. And the resistance was in some cases very fierce. This is called often territorial protection. The people in classical music, many of them, didn't want their music contaminated, in quotes, by jazz. And jazz purists particularly didn't want any of the influence of what they considered effete or academic music in the classical area. But of course, what they neglected to understand was that both musics, if we talk about classical and jazz as sort of major musical mainstreams, both musics have a lot to learn from each other, even to this day. I mean, classical music can learn a hell of a lot about rhythm and swing and momentum and motion in music and spontaneity through the improvisational aspects of jazz. On the other hand, jazz can learn an awful lot and still has to learn it, I think, about form and how you write or improvise extended pieces, you know, pieces beyond a 3-minute or 10-minute duration.
Well, I want to play something that you wrote that is in a third-stream style, and it's part of a larger piece that you wrote called Seven Studies on Themes of Paul Klee. Let me ask you to just describe what's happening in this excerpt of the piece.
Well, this is one of many third stream pieces that I've written, and I've used a different approach to this idea in all these pieces. This is one that happens to have been written for a symphony orchestra, which means that you could not use improvisation, certainly not in 1959 when I wrote this piece. Symphony musicians are not trained in improvising, certainly not in a jazz style. So this piece is entirely written, but, of course, it tries to emulate the whole feeling of a jazz piece, only now not for a big band or a small group, but for a whole symphony orchestra. And the idea came to me, this is one of the Paul Klee paintings, it's called The Little Blue Devil. And blue and the blues sort of immediately makes me think of jazz, of course, and the blues. And so this has a kind of blues-jazz feeling, and particularly through the rhythm, the walking bass line and the muted trumpet solo and so on, various elements that relate to jazz.
Okay, so this is from the Seven Studies on Themes of Paul Klee, composed by my guest Gunther Schuller, performed by the Boston Symphony Orchestra with Eric Leinsdorf conducting. And I should mention that this is one of Gunther Schuller's most widely performed pieces. So let's hear it. An excerpt of Gunther Schuller's Seven Studies on Themes of Paul Klee. How did you find a drummer like that in an orchestra?
Well, at that time, they had a drummer named Tommy Thompson, whom I knew from my days in Cincinnati, who was always sort of oriented towards jazz, so we were lucky in having that. I tell you, if you mess around with jazz, you better have a good drummer and a good bass player.
Really?
Otherwise, you're in trouble.
Now, you once wrote that you never really cared whether the term third stream stuck or not, but I'm sure that you did care whether the idea was furthered or not. Where do you see third stream type music heading now? Where do you see that marriage of jazz and classical music heading?
Well, it's expanded tremendously. And in my original postulation of this, I was mainly concerned with classical music, contemporary classical music, and jazz. But what has happened, particularly through some of my disciples in this, particularly Rand Blake, this amazing improvising pianist, is that it has been extended to include not just jazz as a popular or folk or dance music, but all kinds of ethnic, folk, and vernacular musics from all over the world. And, of course, this is most appropriate in our times because the whole world of music has been opened up to us in recent decades through recordings and television and radio. I mean, there is no music on the face of this globe that we can not know about nowadays, so that you can have now a third stream which combines, let's say, Greek bouzouki music with atonal classical music and with elements of jazz.
Now, you talk about opening up different worlds of music. I think many of us have you to thank for introducing us to different forms of music. You've played an important role in expanding the repertory of jazz and pop music. For instance, you're at the forefront of you know, the, excuse the expression, ragtime revival.
It's all right.
A few years ago.
That's what it was.
Yeah, and you found all kinds of interesting things that were, that had been totally forgotten by history. And I wonder what inspired you to look back to the turn of the century music.
Well, I've been asked that question many times, and I always find it difficult to explain. Again, a lot of the seeds for these kinds of interests, I guess, were sown in my childhood somehow, and I don't recall exactly how all that happened and developed. But many people think of me as a modernist, as a radical in music, you know, someone who's always sort of at the avant-garde of music. But I'm also, and this is what people sometimes don't know and forget, I'm also quite a traditionalist, and I'm very interested in always, A, making links back to the past, the recent past or the far past, and to preserve of those earlier traditions, be they popular or classical or whatever, those things which are really eternal and therefore of great value to preserve, and then to perhaps rejuvenate or renew or use in some new way, but never to lose that connection with the past. And I knew about Joplin's music since I'm a teenager, but I never could do anything about it as a French horn player. There isn't much you can do with piano rags. But when I got a hold of these orchestrations from the first decade of the century, the nickname of the Red Back Book of Rags, then I went to town, this was during my time at the New England Conservatory, and created a ragtime ensemble immediately.
Well, I'd like to play one of the rags that you arranged from an album called From Rags to Jazz, which features the New England Conservatory Ragtime Ensemble. Let's play Heliotrope Bouquet by Louis Chauvin. Do you want to say anything about what you thought of when you were arranging this?
Well, my main interest was in keeping the classic style of ragtime pure. I mean, to keep a kind of period authenticity in these arrangements. It would have been very easy to update them or modernize them or to make them very fancy, but I was very interested in keeping in the pure classical style. And I learned that from the Red Back Book arrangements, which of course we performed, and that sort of gave me a sense of how those things were arranged in those days and how they were played.
Could you just explain briefly what the Red Back Book arrangements are?
Well, the Red Back Book is that's a nickname for a collection of printed orchestrated rags. The real title was 15 High-Class Syncopated Rags.
Okay, well, let's hear the Heliotrope Bouquet arranged by my guest Gunther Schuller. A really nice arrangement of that.
For the record, we ought to say that piece was composed by two composers, Louis Chauvin and Scott Joplin. Scott Joplin rescued that piece from oblivion. Chauvin died before he could finish the piece, and Joplin, who had heard the first two strains played to him by Chauvin, decided to finish this beautiful rag. So that's how come we have it.
Well, I want to talk with you more about music and about your life, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is composer, conductor, arranger, educator, author, and music critic Gunther Schuller, and we'll be back after this break. This is Fresh Air. Gunther Schuller is my guest. Now, your father played in an orchestra. What did he play?
He was a violinist in the New York Philharmonic, many other orchestras, but primarily in the New York Philharmonic.
Did you hang out with him when you were a kid in the orchestra?
Yes, he took me to concerts. I guess I went to concerts in my mother's womb already. My whole childhood was filled with classical music and going to concerts of the New York Philharmonic and other New York ensembles and organizations. But interestingly, I didn't become conscious of wanting to be a musician until I was about 11. I was a rather late starter.
Well, were you intimidated by the caliber of musicianship that your father and his friends had?
No, that wasn't it. I was interested in art. I wanted to be a painter and an artist. And it's interesting that in some of my later musical works, I refer so often and associate myself with works of art, as in the case of the Seven Studies on Themes of Paul Klee. I wanted to be an artist, but at age 11, somehow all this musical knowledge and information and love for music that I had came out, and then suddenly it was very clear that I wanted to be a musician of some sort.
Now, you started your career playing in orchestras, but you gave that up. Why?
Well, I was playing in the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra as principal horn. I was there for some 15 years, one of the most exciting and great musical periods in my life. But by around 1959, if I'm trying to make this sound modest, my fame as a composer had become such that I was getting commissions from all over and from so many sources that I began to literally kill myself physically trying to be a French horn player by day and a composer by night. So I knew something had to give, and most reluctantly, because I loved the French horn and I loved playing in the opera, I gave up the horn. I mean, my primary calling, I always knew since the age of 11, was as a composer, and so that had to take priority.
Does this mean you never play anymore?
I haven't played for about 23 years. After I left the Met, I did freelance work in New York in the studios, you know, playing everything from symphonic music to jazz and pop music. But you cannot be a part-time horn player. There's just no way. The embouchure, the muscles and all of that just won't take that kind. It's like sports. You have to sort of keep in training all the time. So eventually I had to give up the horn. And, of course, people were saying to me, you know, composers like Aaron Copland and Bill Schumann, saying, you know, if you're leaving this very good employment at the Metropolitan Opera, you're taking a great risk because you're not supposed to be able to make a living as a composer. But somehow I managed that. And during the 60s, I lived and worked as a composer. I had to work very hard, of course, because that's a difficult life. Composing and music making is not exactly one of the exalted, financially most remunerative professions.
Now, as a composer, you've written that professional symphony musicians are sometimes embittered, disgruntled, bored musicians who have come to hate music. Now, did you ever feel that way at all when you were a symphony orchestra musician?
Not one second, not one minute, nor did my father, by the way, who played in the New York Philharmonic all those years. I mean, all through the years, and later when he played with the Cleveland Symphony and the Cincinnati Symphony and many other orchestras, he always enjoyed playing until he was age 82. And I knew quite a few other musicians who loved playing the great literature. But then there were also those, and perhaps I overstated a little bit in that sentence which you're quoting, there were always those who were, in fact, somehow embittered and disappointed, and to the point where sometimes they didn't even enjoy playing the great literature of Tchaikovsky, Brahms, Beethoven, whatever. I always found that amazing.
Well, I guess that was hard for you as a composer when an orchestra would play your music, and you felt that they were bored and embittered.
Yes, or beyond that, hating music. I mean, many of these same musicians hate all contemporary music. I suppose it's because they find it too difficult. They have to think, they have to work hard, they have to practice. It just doesn't roll off their fingers, so to speak, as some of the more well-known literature does. But I wasn't reacting to that so much because of the reactions to my own music, but more, I felt very unhappy that, for example, when Mahler symphonies were being played by the New York Philharmonic in those days, most of the musicians would gripe like mad about having to play these, what they thought were overly long symphonies. I mean, it's such a simplistic point of view. And some of the language that went on during the rehearsals, you know, while a man like Bruno Walter or Dimitri Mitropoulos was rehearsing these marvelous pieces, it was a shock to my system. I just couldn't believe that people could be so embittered and hateful in the very thing which they chose as their profession.
Do you think this is changing, this kind of bitter streak that you noticed?
It has improved a great deal, yes. And I can't explain why exactly, but I think some of it has to do with, of course, an influx of several generations now of younger musicians who are also more versatile and more varied and in their own view of music, the kind of thing we were talking about earlier. They relate to other musics besides the classical music, so they have a broader interest in the larger aspects of the field of music.
We heard earlier a piece that you composed that was a third stream piece, a piece that combined jazz and classical forms. I want to play an excerpt of a piece that's really not. And this is a string quartet that you wrote, the String Quartet Number 2. It's interesting to me that some of your pieces would be that jazz influence and some of them really not at all.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because one of the things, one of my problems with my life and my career is I get typecast so easily, and there are people who know me only as Mr. Ragtime, and then there are people who know me only in the jazz context, and then there are other people who know me only as that composer who writes all that difficult atonal 12-tone music. The point is that I love to write in all of these styles and conceptions and work in them as a performer. And out of the 130 pieces that I've written so far in my life, I think there's probably only about 25 or 30 that are involved with jazz or third stream. What's interesting is that very often my non-third stream pieces, non-jazz pieces, get reviewed by critics, for example, as being in this third stream arena. And I'm always quite amused and bemused by that.
Let's play an excerpt of your String Quartet Number 2 with the Emerson String Quartet performing. We've heard very different kinds of music that you've composed. What do you actually listen to at home?
Everything. our radio or our record players are on all the time, and I listen to everything from A to Z. I just love all... I have a voracious appetite for music, seemingly.
Now, you've been an educator. I think we need to talk about this. For 10 years, you were the head of the New England Conservatory. Now, you've criticized the education system in the United States for failing in all cultural matters, and you've said that you think that music education has always been shortchanged. How have you tried to remedy that in your work as an educator?
Well, by talking and by writing articles and by being an advocate for the arts in our education, I must say I don't think I've been incredibly successful. I think the fate of the arts in education today is worse than it was perhaps 30 or 40 years ago.
How so?
Well, I mean, there's just less of it. When you look at some other countries, Japan, Hungary, Germany, other European countries, And you see the amount of music or the other arts that is taught right in the school system, and you compare that with what happens in the United States, it's pretty deplorable here. This is almost a kind of national crisis at this point. And therefore, I mean, it's an issue which neither Gunther Schuller nor a few other well-intentioned people can solve.
You have a forthcoming book coming out, which is called The Swing Era. It's a companion to your earlier book, Early Jazz. I assume that to write this book on the swing era, you went back and listened to a lot of recordings that you already knew. Were there things that you've changed your mind about recently in putting this book together?
Well, quite a few things. Incidentally, I did listen to about 35,000 recordings.
Must have kept you busy.
Oh, it did. And part of the reason why the book took almost 15 years to write. Of course, I have to say that during some of those periods, times there were 2 or 3 years where I didn't write a single word or couldn't work on the book at all. Well, I don't know that I changed my mind so much, but I certainly made some very interesting discoveries. To put it simply, I think I have brought back to life certain major figures, what I think are major figures in jazz, which have until now been very much neglected, sometimes completely neglected, or treated very badly in the available jazz histories. On the other hand, I think I've also been able to demythify, to debunk some of the myths surrounding certain figures in the history of jazz.
In your book, Early Jazz, you wrote that very few jazz books have attempted to deal with the music in anything more general than descriptive or impressionistic terms. That's something you've tried to remedy with your writing. Do you think that jazz criticism has changed in that respect?
Oh, I think it is much better now than it was some 30, 40 years, although there were some quite brilliant writers, but they didn't, as you've just said, write particularly in any great detail about the music. There are now many more musically trained jazz writers and critics, although the emphasis seems to be still in most books that are published on this subject in the sort of anecdotal or historical aspects of jazz.
You've written about jazz a lot during your life, and so many of your articles are prefaced with the statement of, gosh, it's hard to put into words anything about music. Yet you've persisted with that challenge.
Well, I keep struggling with it. It is hard to talk about an oral art, music, in verbal terms, but I like to think that I'm getting a little better at it through the years, particularly in this swing era book. I think I made some breakthroughs in talking about the music in a cogent and informative and illustrative way.
Well, Gunther Schuller, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
My guest has been composer, conductor, and arranger Gunther Schuller. He's also a music critic and music historian. His forthcoming book, The Swing Era, is a companion to his book, Early Jazz. The Swing Era will be published by Oxford. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.